2020 Guggenheim Fellow and award-winning poet Aimé Nezhukumatathil has a new collection of essays from Milkweed Editions that's touted as a best book this fall. World of Wonders in Praise of Fireflies, Whale Sharks, and Other Astonishments made me recall our 2009 interview with Park University's Ethnic Voices Poetry Series when the then newly named NEA Fellow admitted that nature is her biggest inspiration. But her work is also filled with love, humor, and stories about her family, as you'll hear in this conversation about her first two poetry books, Miracle Fruit and At the Drive-In Volcano. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air from UMKC's New Letters magazine. And before I got into a discussion with this first-generation American who was born in Chicago in 1974, I needed help with the pronunciation of her name. So she told me a story that will make you remember it too.
Every April for National Poetry Month, a group of us go into the local elementary school and teach poetry. I always tell them, you know, my last name is the same sound as the song from The Lion King, Hakuna Matata. So in order to pronounce it, I have them sing Nezhukumatathil, and they all get it, you know. So I tell my college students, there's no excuse. If a five-year-old can say it, then you can say it too. But they still call me Professor Nez, so that's all right.
Yeah. Well, Nez is a great way to shorten it, I
sure,
think.
Sure.
You know, since we're starting with your name, I might get you to read the poem that ends your first book.
All right. My name. At four, I was ready. Fat pencil and paper, lined the way I like it best. Two strong sky blue lines with a dotted line in between the two. A soft ceiling for the tops of lowercase letters to brush up against. In New Guinea, to identify a person's family, you can ask, what is the name of your canoe? My seventh grade social studies teacher made up a dance to help him remember how to pronounce my name. He'd break it into sharp syllables, shake his corduroyed hips at roll call, his bulge of keys rattling in time. I don't remember who first shortened it to Nez, but I loved the zip of it, the sport and short of it, until the day I learned Nez means nose in French. Translation, beloved nose. My father tells me part of our name comes from a flower from the South Indian coast. I wonder what it smells like, what fragrance I always have dabbed at my neck. Scientists say some flowers don't have a scent, but I think they do. Even if it's hints of sweat from blooms too long without drink, or the promise of honey from the scratchings of a thin bee leg, feathered with loosestrife and sage. I wonder if I've ever smelled our flower, if the smell ever wafted clear across the ocean. I know I would swim out to meet it, brush the salt and bits of pink shell away, and apologize for the messiness of my hair.
That's the ending poem from the collection Miracle Fruit. It's called My Name, and Miracle Fruit is the first book by Aimé Nezhukumatathil, and it was the winner of the Tupelo Press Judges Prize in Poetry back in, what year was that, 2003?
It was published in 2003. I think it actually won the prize in 2002.
And was it published as a result of being the prize winner?
Yes.
And then they went ahead and published your second collection.
That's right.
Which doesn't always happen. I mean, you know, it's a wonderful thing if a press follows a writer, but that's not always the case, is it?
That's right. Tupelo has been just terrific to me, and they always were very interested in starting kind of a Tupelo family. When I first was scanning the pages of different literary magazines looking for contests to submit my first book, Tupelo at the time was brand new. I think they had only one contest winner before me. So it was kind of a risk in some ways, you know, submitting my manuscript there. But I loved the first books that they came out with, and I couldn't have been more pleased with how I've been treated afterwards. They really were interested in developing, you know, not just, oh, this is an author this year, and let's turn to the next flavor of the month next year. You know, they really wanted to help each of us grow as individual poets. So.
Yeah. Well, going back to My Name, this poem that ends your first book, it's dealing with your very long name, but you really are multicultural because your father was from India and your mother was from the Philippines. And we find out a lot of this information in your book, Miracle Fruit. And I kept thinking I was going to find out somewhere how they met, but I didn't really find that out. Tell me a little
bit
about the background.
It's a funny story in some ways. Both of them were huge Elvis Presley fans in their respective countries, you know, in India and the Philippines. My mom, I know, would watch all the Elvis movies, you know, in the 60s, playing in the movie houses in their town in the Philippines. And my dad had the sideburns like Elvis. They met in Chicago in the late 60s, and their first date actually was an Elvis Presley concert. And this was unheard of. I mean, on my dad's side of the family, there was arranged marriages for generations and generations and generations. My dad is Catholic and my mom is Methodist, so that initially didn't sit well with my mom's family as well, too, you know. And so it was really interesting. I'm always still kind of in awe that my dad even knew what a date was. They don't really have dating, at least at the time, in South India. So Elvis brought my parents together in some ways from their different countries and into Chicago.
Well, just because I think it does give some insight into your own story, I think I'm going to have you read a couple more poems from Miracle Fruit.
Okay.
The first one is called Fishbone.
Fishbone. At dinner, my mother says, if one gets stuck in your throat, roll some rice into a ball and swallow it whole. She says things like this, and then the next thing out of her mouth is, did you know Madonna is pregnant? But I want to ponder the basket of fried smelt on the table, lined with paper towels to catch the grease. I want to study their eyes like flat soda, wonder how I'm supposed to eat them whole. I wonder why we can't have normal food for breakfast, like at Sarah's house, Cheerios, or sometimes if her mother's at home, buttered toast and soft-boiled eggs in her grandmother's dainty blue egg cups and matching blue spoon. Safe. Pretty. Nothing with eyes. Under the flakes of fried crust, I see a shimmer of skin as silver as foil, like the dimes my mother tapes to a board for each year that I'm alive. How she tucked this into my suitcase before I left for college, and I forgot about the years 93 and 95. And how she said she'll never find a 93 now. Wouldn't this have been a great thing to one day put into an oak frame, but not now, not until we find the missing coin? We don't have many traditions left, thanks to your father, she says. These are the things she says instead of a blessing to our food. These are the words that stick inside me as I snap off the next head.
Fishbone, from the collection Miracle Fruit by Amy Nzukumatatel. There's another poem in Miracle Fruit that I'd like to have you read. And this one gives a little more insight into your dad's side. And it's called Table Manners.
That was a poem that I wrote on my sister and I's first visit to India as adults. We went when I was in grad school without our father, and we went to spend a half a summer with my grandmother in southern India. And we didn't really have, I would call a culture shock or anything. We both had been to India before, and we knew that in South India, my dad's family eats these really great, ultra-delicious, extravagant, huge meals with their hands. So we were prepared for it, but it was something to be taken aback a little bit just in the first few days that we were there, how there was no prim and proper dabbing the corners of your mouth with a napkin or clicking very daintily with knife and fork. But everybody seemed to just be having this boisterous good time, really just enjoying the food, feeling it's almost a sensual feeling to be able to feel the food as you're eating it with your hands. Truthfully, by the end of the visit, we were eating with our hands. I still believe it makes the food taste even better when you eat it with your hands. So.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I think that's what I liked about that poem is it captured that sort of gusto, that sort
sure.
of passion for, you know, not just food, but for life in a way.
Yes, this poem is in South India. I'll just read it. In India, northerners pride themselves on eating only with their fingertips, while southerners enjoy their foods with the entire hand, to the wrist if need be. No wonder my sister Joanne and I sit stunned at the dinner table as our cousins scoop and slurp their lunch. Dried fish in gingilli oil, puri soaked first in sambar, then cooled in cucumber raita. I motion to Umana, the servant girl. Do you have fork? Spoon? She laughs a little longer than necessary, then disappears into the storage room. Each finger lick makes us grimace, but secretly, I want to join them in slick smacking this beautiful food. The three-year-old sees my fork and cries until he gets one of his own to bang and draw lines in his plate of sauce. No one here ever wishes you happiness, and now I know why. This is supposed to be of your own doing, your own relish, of your own open hands.
Table Manners is from the collection Miracle Fruit, winner of the Tupelo Press Judges Prize in Poetry in 2002, and it was published in 2003. I'm talking today with Amy Nzukumatatil, and this is New Letters on the Air. In some ways, it seemed to me that Miracle Fruit, because we do get to explore the different aspects of your background, and there are parts of it that reveals this very exotic story about these two cultures coming together in yet a third culture, mm-hmm. that it almost reads like a coming-of-age story in some ways to me. Mm-hmm. Did you have that feeling? Because the poems at the beginning, I felt really changed from the poems towards the end. The ones towards the end were a little less narrative, but, you know, it was interesting to see that kind of development. And I wondered if the poems that were earlier in the book were actually poems that you had written earlier, or what happened with the development of this book?
Actually, a good part of it started as my thesis from Ohio State. So I would say about a third to maybe half the poems were from my grad school thesis, but they're all scattered kind of throughout the book, so that it's definitely not arranged in chronological order in terms of when I wrote them. But I did want to have kind of an arc so that the reader takes a trip along with me in terms of starting out with, here's the introduction to really who I am as a poet and who I am as a person, giving a little bit of a background of my father, giving a little background of my mother, and then kind of taking me along exploring a little bit of high school life, but then really developing as a young woman and just being out on my own as well and having my own relationships. So I very much wanted there to be, a progression from starting out with a narrative history, but then kind of exploring the larger world. You know, here's this interesting fish that I've discovered, or here's a interesting flower, something about, you know, nature like that, so that it's not all in my own personal history, because frankly, I would be just so bored writing about myself the whole time. And really, that's what I think is the most interesting part of it as well. I'm actually very drawn to nature writing, and I teach environmental literature at Fredonia.
Oh, do you really?
So I wanted to showcase my interests as well. I wanted to utilize parts from nature and then try to make a kind of a larger statement about just life, relationships, that kind of thing. One of the things I'm proud of in both collections is that while some of the relationships in there may not always be exactly autobiographical, anything from nature or science was all heavily researched, actually. It's all true. It's not just the poet making up some fanciful animal to make the story good or anything like that. Most of what I read is science books and books on wildlife and different birds, that kind of thing. So I wanted to incorporate that as well. One of the common questions I get is, how much of the book is true? I'm a little coy with the relationships part, but one thing I can say is that all the aspects about nature and biology and science, those are all actually true. Those are all factual. You can look them up.
What is the miracle fruit? Because it comes up in one of your poems. So.
Sure. At the time when I first wrote about it, I think some people were thinking I was using my poet's license and making things up again. But it actually is a fruit. I'm happy to say now the New York Times just featured it just within the last year as being the hip new fruit. It's an actual fruit that my father found kind of in a roadside stand in Florida back in the early 2000s. And the man who sold it really just said, oh, you know, if you take one bite of this, everything you eat will be sweet. When somebody tells you that on a roadside stand, you don't really believe it right away. But my parents, they're connoisseurs of all kinds of different tropical fruits. So, of course, they bought that. And sure enough, the fruits themselves are about the size of red jelly beans. And you take a bite of one, and then you can eat anything, a saltine cracker, a lemon. They all end up tasting sweet. So the saltine cracker tastes like a graham cracker, for example. It becomes sweet. And this lasts for about a half hour or sometimes even more, depending on how many miracle fruits you eat. When Miracle Fruit won the Forward Magazine's Poetry Book of the Year prize, my press actually sent me a miracle fruit shrub. So it was really kind of neat to see the fruits blooming in Western New York. And
oh, that's cool. Well, I might get you to read that poem since we're talking about it.
Okay, great. This is the frontispiece poem in Miracle Fruit, and it's called One Bite. Miracle fruit changes the tongue. One bite, and for hours all you eat is sweet. Placed alone on the saucer, it quivers like it's cold from the ceramic, even in this Florida heat. Small as a coffee bean, red as jam, I can't believe it. The man who sold it to my father on Interstate 542 had one tooth, one sandal, and called me Dutta, Dutta. I wanted to ask, what is that? But the red's buds teased me into our car and away from his fruit stand. One bite. And if you eat it whole, it softens and swells your teeth like a mouthful of mallow. So how long before you lose a sandal and still walk? How long before you lose the sweetness?
That's Amy Nezukumatatl reading One Bite, which is from her first book, Miracle Fruit. This is New Letters on the Air. Well, I'm going to change to another fruit now. I'm going to go to another fun poem that's in your newer book that kind of brings your two parents together. And it's almost like an argument. In a way, it's bringing these two exotic cultures together, and it's over a piece of fruit, and it's called Origin of the Mango, and this is from your second collection, At the Drive-In Volcano.
Origin of the Mango. Of course, my parents can't agree. My father says one of its flat, stringy seeds floated all the way from India and just happened to land on the Philippine shoreline. Anything good comes from India, according to my father. Such as swirls of calligraphy, counting, the darkest, purest gold hammered into rings and loopy bangles, paprika, and web-thin silks that sent hundreds of pirates in a frenzied search to the east. But mangoes? My mother doesn't buy it. She says the queen fruit of her beloved islands came from a tree growing in the spot where a Filipina named Malanga pierced her heart through with a knife. The girl's parents wanted her to marry someone she did not love, a regular Juliet. The tree grows bold and thick in the swell of winter, pushes out a dozen heart-shaped fruits so we don't forget. I think of my parents, their hands slip into mangoes with knife blade, fingers fly lightly over the skins. Different countries, same blood, hungry for this fruit. Its flesh like cold sweetmeat, fiber spun gold, sweet pulp in the teeth. The fight over the seed, who gets to suck each sugary fiber from the pit, only curls their wet hands together even more, only gets more gold juice, the right story.
That's Origin of the Mango. I'm talking with Amy Nezukumatatl, and that's from a later section in the book, At the Drive-In Volcano. It's just kind of fun to have your parents both in this poem, you know, arguing about something. And it's so perfect that it's a piece of fruit because, again, you're bringing that outer world into the personal world and combining the two in a poem like that. Mm-hmm. But that you're also very aware of nature. And in fact, this entire book, why don't you talk about the way that you've arranged it, because it all has to do with nature.
Sure. My second book was arranged in 5 sections. They're all kind of divided into thematic sections based on a volcano's lifespan, actually. So they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but there's a little subheading of different kind of volcanic elements. One of them is pillow lava, which is lava that forms in this really kind of bulbous, beautiful, it looks like it's fluffy and soft, but it's actually obviously not. It's burning hot. It's just it's developing underwater. Little rocks that are formed from the lava called lapilli. What happens when a volcano kind of finishes off and produces kind of a single wave. It looks like a frozen wave from the ocean, that kind of thing in the sky. So I kind of liked that as a movement. This traces a development. It starts with the end of a relationship and then kind of progresses on to another relationship, which would eventually become my husband. To me, I wanted to write about these subjects very much, but I also was aware that many people may not want to read it. I mean, this is at heart a book of relationships, longing, loss, and love, ultimately love and hope again, and joy. But again, I didn't want to write from the straight confessional viewpoint. I feel like I just had done that a lot, but I wanted to kind of also find ways where I can make the feelings and the observations that I was noticing applicable to other people, you know, and the way I did that was through the thread of nature and just finding connections. Some of these are not so exotic. These are not, you know, talking about the origins of how a robin's breast became red, you know, that kind of thing. So it's not necessarily finding these unusual animals, but just finding kind of the unheralded stories of these kind of everyday animals and plants, but as well as kind of making some of these plants and animals that maybe aren't discussed in poetry so often, a little bit more accessible to the average reader as well.
You have such a way of also incorporating your sense of humor into this. I mean, it comes out so clearly. Is this something that you work at when you're writing poetry, or is it just something that just kind of flashes up that you see the humor in a moment and you're able to capture it with just a few words?
Well, it's definitely not anything that I sit and try to think, today I'm going to write a funny poem, you know, but I'm so touched and honored that you said that, because my friends will all attest to this, my husband will attest to this. I know I have a cheeseball sense of humor, and I'm really at heart a big dork. But I think I can really look at situations and find just the natural humor out of it. I really don't have to work at all at it, because really if you just take a look at cultural differences, there is so much laughter and joy to be found in it, you know, and if you just don't take yourself so seriously, I think that kind of humor just naturally comes out. And that's the kind of stuff that I enjoy sharing with my friends and my family. And really, that's one of the most favorite parts for me about just writing, really, is finding the joy and delight in everyday objects.
Yeah. Well, anybody who names her dog Villanelle after a form of poetry, I read that in one of the notes, I think, of your second book.
Only kind of other poets or English majors know what that is. I think most people, you know, my neighbors call her Vanilla, you know, that kind of thing. They just, you know, so yeah.
Out of all the poetic forms to name a dog, why did you choose Villanelle?
Oh, you know, it's just the Villanelle for me personally was always one of the most maddening forms to write. You have to find that kind of obsessive subject, but you also have to have some trickery and magic with rhyme as well, you know, and I was never really happy with any of the Villanelles I wrote, really until about the time it just coincidentally happened when I opened my email one time, and in my inbox there was a picture of a dog that needed a good home, a geriatric dachshund. And I went to school that day not knowing that I would be coming home with a geriatric dachshund. I took one look at the dog and fell in love, and that was the thing that was going on in my life. I was finally kind of getting a good grasp on the Villanelle form, and she kind of had a little villainess kind of way to her, so I just thought it all worked out. And, you know, just, again, I'm a big dork, so I just thought that was kind of a funny name to call her, and it really stuck. You know, she's a little bit deaf now, but she comes when she's called by her name, and yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Is the poem that you were working on at that point, is it published in either of these books?
I went on this Villanelle binge, really, for months, and I think maybe about two or three of them are in the Drive-In Volcano, yeah.
Well, why don't we have you read one of those?
Okay. This is a poem called Dog Custody.
How appropriate.
This was during the time I always joked that Villanelle was my rebound. A relationship I had through grad school recently ended, and we shared a dog, you know. And so, you know, the form of the Villanelle, it deals with kind of obsessive subjects that you can't get out of your head. So I thought that was an appropriate form for the subject of missing a former dog that I shared with a former boyfriend. It's a poem that has five stanzas where the first and the third line of each stanza rhyme. And then the second line of each stanza rhymes as well. And it all ends in a quatrain where you include kind of all the rhymes together. So it's, like I said, it's a maddening form, and I was really never the greatest with rhyming, but it just really, something clicked during those months when I adopted Villanelle. So this is called Dog Custody. When you are in love, you make silly choices. Selecting him was easy. It was the only blue dog we'd ever seen. It's hard to forget his bark, a cloud of furry voices. As we left the pet store, we laughed at the invoice listing all the toys and food so expensive, so obscene. When you are in love, you make silly choices. But after we broke up, we couldn't make choices regarding who gets to see him without being mean. I can't sleep in the dark. What are those scary noises? What about the Sundays we left him to rejoice at church? Can you forget how you leaned towards me in love, how you sang Faith's praises? In my car, I found one of his frayed old leashes from the last time at the park. He came back unclean. He barked at the geese, a cloud of winged voices. You win. I give up. He always listened to you best. Chases squirrels, but he always returned. If a new girl comes, I'll turn green. When you fall out of love, you make silly choices. 300 miles away, I still hear your voices.
Dog Custody, a villanelle that's included in the collection At the Drive-In Volcano by Amy Nezukumatatl. This is New Letters on the Air. I think that might be one of the hardest forms to do, and to do it where it flows so gracefully, I think, is even harder.
You.
And how funny that it should be about a dog, not the same dog, but that it should be about a dog. I mean, that's so perfect. And I'm not sure where to go from here.
I'd love to read a love poem.
There are so many poems
because
there are
breakups and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's how the book ends anyway, so. Okay, actually, I'll read the title poem from this collection. This is At the Drive-In Volcano, and there's an actual place that's called the Drive-In Volcano. I didn't make that up. My husband and I honeymooned in St. Lucia. We wanted to stay away from all those touristy, you know, everybody plays trivia nights, that kind of thing, and all the couples play shuffleboard or something like that. So we went to kind of an environmentally, they called it a green resort. There's no electricity. It was built into the side of a mountain, but the fourth wall is open to the hillside, so there's no fence or anything. So if you step out a little too far, you tumble down the side of a mountain. It's really terrific. And on St. Lucia, that just in the distance, there's the only active volcano that you could actually drive up, really up until the edge of it. So that was the one touristy thing we did during the whole time. I couldn't leave an island when knowing that there was a drive-in volcano, and it was called the drive-in volcano. This is At the Drive-In Volcano. I am a very different wife. Sulfur and ash fill my nose until both nostrils are beige, my hands hot and webbed with steam. My new husband urges me closer to the center of the steaming caldera for a picture until I'm up against the rail. Our guide tells us of a Rasta man who once fell in and survived. His entire body turned smooth as a candle. Come with me, husband. Put down your backpack, your camera. Let us be remarried in fire. One by one, the stars go out. Even in this darkness, there is so much light.
That's the title poem from At the Drive-In Volcano by Amy Nezukumatatl, her second poetry book that won the 2007 Balcones Poetry Prize. She also read from her first award-winning book, Miracle Fruit, after appearing at the Kansas City Public Library as part of Park University's 2009 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. She's since written two more poetry collections, Lucky Fish and Oceanic, and now in 2020 is a Guggenheim Fellow with her first essay book called World of Wonders, in praise of fireflies, whale sharks, and other astonishments. For links, go to newletters.org, where you can hear other classic shows and subscribe to UMKC's New Letters magazine. If you're interested in joining our team to keep New Letters on the air, write to radio@newletters.org or call and leave a message at 888-548-2477. That's 888-LIT. Airs. Today's show was originally produced with Dennis Conroe, Molly Lesher, and Eric Motter, with music by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks also to Olivia Gallo, Adriana Macias, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.